As you just heard, and as a reminder, Megan is also recording our webinar, and that enables us to be able to send both the PowerPoint to you as well as the audio portion of our presentation today. And we hope that that can be very useful for you and your faith communities. We encourage you to share that with others, and that will be sent out over the next couple of days. If anybody is on the call, but you've not yet been able to link in to the visual portion, just a reminder that you can find that by typing in to your computer https://, and then join.me/, and then the word spelled out faith, the number 4, and the word immigration. Again, that's join.me/ FAITH, number 4, immigration. So we hope that you're able both to hear us and to see the first slide of the PowerPoint, which is up on the screen. And again, we really want to welcome you to what is now already our second webinar of February, and the second webinar of 2016 here in February. I'm Reverend Sharon Stanley Ray, the Director of Refugee Immigration Ministries for the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, and I am very grateful to be a member together with 46 other national faith organizations and denominations as a part of the very vibrant Interfaith Immigration Coalition. And we're especially glad today that you are a part of that team and the broader network throughout the country. And we're thankful that you've taken time to join us today. We're thankful for your ongoing work in the network and the ways that you are committed to having your faith remain active by voicing it for immigrant and refugee rights. You might remember, perhaps had an opportunity to join us last month as we focused on faith responses to families and individuals who were targeted by ICE raids that were announced, sadly, just around the time of the holidays. And likely, I imagine many of you are also among the now, we were able to confirm earlier today, the more than 136,000 people who have signed on to petitions to urge the administration to stop those raids. We're going to be providing some updates about that and ways you can continue to connect to help protect those who have come to the U.S. seeking protection, who have been targeted by those raids. We'll talk about that at the end of our time. But we have the opportunity first to really focus our time on learning from two experts who can help us peel back the curtains and especially understand the relationships between migrant populations and root causes within Central America that have continued tragically to escalate the violence and the horror there within the Northern Triangle region. They'll be helping us consider our topic of today, faith responses to border militarization and Central American asylum seekers. What we know is that this topic comes during a time of international border protection efforts and pushbacks to many migrants in Austria of Syrian and other migrants. You may have heard in the news today the changing policies in Denmark, considering confiscation of resources now of incoming migrants as they're seeking asylum at their borders. In that global context, we also know we find ourselves at the official beginning of the election today with the caucuses in Iowa, health concerns being felt in Central America as well, and especially that these discussions are ones that on this day and every day call upon us to reflect about the faith connections of our nation's own border policies. And so we're going to turn now to our two speakers, the first of whom I am very honored to introduce you to is Jennifer Johnson. who serves as the policy advisor for the Southern Border Communities Coalition and working through Church World Service. Secondly, we'll be hearing and learning from Shana Hebert, the policy director and the National Advocacy Office of the Jesuit Conference that's located here in D.C. as well. Both of these women are stars and great colleagues, and we truly are thankful to have an opportunity to seek wisdom from both of you in these areas related to border policies and militarization. So, Jennifer, at this time, we're going to turn it over to you, and you can begin to move us through your slides on the PowerPoint.
Great. Thank you so much. Whoops. I thought I just dropped my phone. Sharon, can you hear me?
We absolutely can. You're
wonderful.
Perfect.
Thank you. That was a great start for my webinar presentation there. Thank you very much for that beautiful introduction, Sharon. Yes, my name is Jenny Johnson. As Sharon mentioned, I'm the policy advisor for the Southern Border Communities Coalition, and I'm based here at Church World Service. I think most of you on the call are familiar with Church World Service, but just a bit about the Southern Border Communities Coalition. It's a coalition of around 60 different human rights, civil rights, faith, and humanitarian aid organizations. They're located at the U.S.-Mexico border on the U.S. side, from San Diego to Brownsville. I imagine that many of you on the call are, maybe you're from a border community, you've spent some time there, and you already have significant background. So some of the issues that I'm going to be covering may be familiar to you. Either way, whether you're a newcomer to looking at border issues or very familiar, I'm appreciative to have this time to speak with you about these, and I hope that this provides some kind of background and context to inform how folks think about the border region and how we approach the region, as well as those who enter our border from the south seeking refuge. So, Megan, if you want to move to the first slide that has the map. Great, thank you. So, for the first slide, I just want to provide just a bit of background about the U.S.-Mexico border region. For starters, the region has approximately 15 million inhabitants, and that's counting both sides of the border, municipalities, counties on both sides of the border. Approximately half of that U.S. border counties and the other half in the Mexican border municipios, municipalities. And just this slide has some other, there's also 154 Native American tribes in four border states, and hundreds of thousands of people cross the border every day, maybe to shop, with the family, do business. And some of the cities on the border are some, I think that there's a mischaracterization in the media that about some of the border towns, but some of the border cities, such as El Paso and San Diego, are some of the most, are some of the safest cities of their size in the region. Switching to the next slide on border militarization. So what I wanted to speak really about today was to give people a bit of context and history about what's been going on at the border for the past decade or two from a policy perspective. For starters, starting around 20 years ago, the U.S. government started a sort of a prevention through deterrence strategy, which meant a massive buildup of enforcement at our southern border. And what that did was it really pushed migrants to cross in ever more remote and dangerous areas. It didn't really deter individuals from crossing because data indicates that other factors such as family unity, the economy, et cetera, have a greater impact on individuals choosing to cross or recross than these other kind of deterrence initiatives that the U.S. government has, whether it's fencing or other kinds of initiatives the government has implemented. So despite this fact, the border buildup has continued full steam ahead over the past 10 years. One way that you can get a sense of the scale of this massive growth at the border, you can look at it through budget and staffing levels of CBP, which is Customs and Border Protection. Before leaping into this, I want to clarify what CBP is. For folks who aren't familiar, CBP, Customs and Border Protection, is formed primarily by two main kind of entities. One is the Border Patrol wears green uniforms, and they conduct enforcement between ports of entry. And then you have OFO, blue uniforms, which is Office of Field Operations, which is not a really great name for customs officers and agents. And they conduct enforcement at ports of entry, whether that's a land port of entry, a maritime, or at an airport. And I want to clarify, I think that there's some misunderstanding sometimes about where the Border Patrol conducts enforcement operations. They do conduct enforcement operations very far removed from the border, including areas where encounters with non-border crossers are the norm. This could be checkpoints in the interior not directly at the border, roving patrols, stopping motorists and pedestrians. Technically, legally, or CBP claims it has the authority to conduct searches anywhere within a reasonable, quote, reasonable distance of any external boundary of the United States. And regulation has defined that reasonable distance as 100 miles. And if you think about it, that means that a huge percentage, they estimate two-thirds of the U.S. population are potentially subject to CBP if you look at both land and maritime borders of the United States. But typically, it's usually within 100 miles of the southwest border. And within 25 miles, CBP can enter private property except dwellings without a warrant. And that kind of, I think people sometimes think of it being a constitution-free zone. However, although the Constitution does apply, there's so many exceptions for CBP in the border region. And in many areas, for folks who aren't from the border region, should know that border residents have to go through checkpoints to go to school, to go to the movies, to go visit family, and so going through these checkpoints is a part of their regular lives. Really you have a very strong feeling whether you're a border resident or a migrant that the region is quite militarized. So what are some of the figures here? Since 2004, you can get a sense of the increase, the exponential growth of CBP and border enforcement looking at some of these figures. Since 2004, you can see that CBP budget has increased 107.5%. And so that means, this is a point of reference, that means that U.S. taxpayers spend more on immigration and border enforcement agencies than on the FBI, DEA, ATF, U.S. Marshals, and Secret Service combined. The number of Border Patrol agents has roughly doubled in the past 10 years. There were approximately 20,000 agents in 2014. And this has made Customs and Border Protection, CBP, our nation's largest law enforcement agency. There are hundreds of miles of pedestrian and vehicular fencing. And one other thing, just thinking back to 2013, I'm sure folks are looking at, listening to some of the discourse, the discussions around the presidential elections and, discussions of doubling and tripling the Border Patrol, and obviously that's already happened in the past 10 years, the doubling. But one concern that the flag is that the last time in 2013 when there was a comprehensive immigration reform bill going through the Senate, there was an amendment that was added at the end offered by Senator Corker from Tennessee and Hovind, Senator Hovind from North Dakota, that would essentially double the number of Border Patrol agents, bringing levels up to around 40,000 agents, deploy more drones at the southern border, and hundreds of miles more fencing at the border. And just wanted to flag for everyone, even though there are other aspects of that bill that were very positive, many of us are very concerned that that not become the starting point for any discussions regarding immigration reform in the future, because those border measures that were included in Corker Hovind amendment just made that bill so toxic and, very harmfully militarize the border region. Go to the next slide. Thanks, Megan. So what are some of the human and civil rights concerns at the border? There's no way on this call I can really touch on all of them, but just to give people a sense of some of the issues of concern, I want to touch on these. One of the main issues is migrant deaths, as well as disappearances. Migrants, I'm sure folks on the call are familiar, die from dehydration, hypo and hyperthermia, and other primarily exposure-related causes. This happens as migrants are forced to cross an ever more isolated, locations away from services and assistance, and just putting themselves at tremendous risk when this happens. So the official figures for 2015 that there were 240 deaths, and that's official figures from Border Patrol. And this followed a pattern similar from past years when most deaths were in South Texas and the Tucson sectors. However, these figures do not paint a full picture. I'm sure everyone understands thousands of remains have been found, but we can only guess at how many thousands of individuals' remains have not been encountered because they aren't, you know, they did pass away, they did die in such isolated stretches of the desert. There are some incredible humanitarian aid organizations in the region that are providing water, food, information, or other assistance to prevent the loss of life, but that is still a huge issue, as well as I said, the disappearance, people knowing that their family members or loved ones have crossed but having no idea what happened to them. And there are other organizations in the border region that are focused on that. Another human rights, civil rights concern at the border has to do with the consequence delivery system. And what is this? This is essentially when individuals are apprehended by Border Patrol, by CBP, at the border, they usually, a consequence quote is applied with the goal as stated as to deter reentry. And some of those consequences are something called ATEP, the Alien Transfer and Exit Program, which means that individuals who are apprehended in one part of the border are then deported to another. You can imagine that that will result in family separation. If one family member was deported in one area, another family member was deported to the other, placing all of the individuals at heightened risk for exploitation and violence and just psychological care of not knowing where your loved one is, of course, being deported to an unfamiliar city by yourself. Another point I just wanted to raise is another consequence are criminal prosecutions for unauthorized entry. This has been going on for roughly 10 years. The government, federal government, has prosecuted unlawful border crossers in group hearings with basically little or no due process. What this has meant is that attorneys from the Department of Justice prosecute for illegal entry, which is a misdemeanor punishable by 6 years. Up to 6 months in prison and illegal reentry, which is a felony punishable up to 20 years. These prosecutions, people might know them, are often referred to as Operation Streamline. They've clogged up federal courts, violated due process rights of thousands of migrants, and as you can imagine, have resulted in huge profits for private prison companies. Other concerns have to do with the treatment of Central American migrant children and families fleeing persecution, which goes to the next piece regarding conditions in CBP detention facilities. When migrants or individuals are apprehended by CBP, they are picked up and they are brought to detention facilities that are not where individuals are not supposed to be housed for more than 72 hours. Obviously, unaccompanied children should be then transferred to Health and Human Services, to ORR. And there have been numerous lawsuits regarding the horrific conditions that individuals endure and those facilities hold, you know, freezing temperatures, lack of access to medical care if they need medical care, lack of access to food, and just horrific conditions in those CBP short-term detention facilities. Another concern in the region, both the southern border and northern border, as well as at other ports of entry, airports, et cetera, is biracial and religious profiling by CBP. I was up in the northern border in Washington State and speaking to organizations where officers improperly questioned detained Muslim or perceived Muslim individuals about their religious beliefs and practices. And then also communities throughout the southern border region and northern border region have documented improper use of racial profiling at checkpoints and roving patrols. Next slide, please. Another issue of tremendous concern, obviously, is deaths by CBP agents. Estimate that since 2010, over 43 individuals have died as a result of an encounter with CBP officials or agents. At least 37 deaths resulted from the use of lethal force. A number of them were U.S. citizens. 9 cases involved shooting in response to alleged rock throwing. There are cases of individuals being shot multiple times through the back, and at least 7 of the victims were under the age of 21. Of 6 of these cross-border fatal shootings, meaning that the individual who was shot and killed was in Mexico at the time, and 3 of them were teenagers. This photo here is an image of Jose Antonio Lena Rodriguez. Some folks on the call may be familiar with his case. When he was 16, he was shot in the back and killed after reportedly throwing rocks at U.S. Border Patrol agents in Nogales, Sonora, and this was in October of 2012. And I think that this case, I've actually gone to the location where he was shot and killed, and it is absolutely unimaginable how anyone could have thrown where he was supposedly located in the fence, how anyone who is not an Olympian could have thrown rocks in, you know, over the fence at that location. What's notable about this case is that last fall, a federal grand jury indicted the agent involved on second-degree murder charge. This indictment, as folks know, allows for a criminal trial to proceed, and this is the first known federal indictment of a Border Patrol agent in a use of force death. So just want to communicate, just one of the huge issues is that not just that these deaths, but that they remain in impunity. Since 2005, there have been 2 other cases of use of force deaths brought by local prosecutors, but those cases were dismissed or ended in hung jury. So there's basically universal impunity for these cases. And so Border Patrol agents who use deadly force face few, if any, public repercussions, even when cases where the justification of the shooting seems dubious. So this is a huge concern. So we want to move to the next slide. So really, I think, There was an article last year that came out in Politico that I think if anyone wants to look at it called Green Monster, and it really I think highlighted how for so many different reasons is that CBP is really an agency out of control, and it's really how it's out of control, lack of accountability and transparency, how it's harmed both border communities and migrants. And here just, you know, I think it has to do with both. There are many, many factors why that's at play, but one of the issues has to do with that there's no accountability within the agency in terms of individuals being held accountable when their abuse or excessive use of force cases do occur. So a lot of organizations are pushing for greater transparency and accountability for these cases. So you can move to the next slide. So what are some of the recommendations and responses? I think the first recommendation would have is obviously halting the militarization of the border region. The border region does not need additional border patrol agents, does not need additional fencing. And one of the things we've been pushing in some of our advocacy is that obviously there should be no additional agents or militarization of the region until there's commensurate accountability and transparency for these cases to ensure the protection of human and civil rights of migrants and border communities. Another kind of recommendation thing that has been pushed is CBP is our nation's largest law enforcement agency. Therefore, law enforcement best practices for accountability and transparency should be applied to CBP. They should not be exempt from these identified best practices. And I really think that we're at a point in our nation of kind of policing crisis and really struggling through this. And I know President Obama has a task force on 21st century policing, and there are a lot of recommendations within that that could be applied to CBP, but that isn't usually part of the conversation. And it's important that we don't forget our nation's largest law enforcement agency when we're talking about reform, law enforcement reform. So what are the things that might set? What are the things, you know, people are discussing, or what are some of the tools to increase accountability for CBP that can be pushed? And one of them is body-worn cameras. That's something increasingly identified as a best practice, with the right policy, the right privacy protections, et cetera, but that could help be a tool because many of the shootings that have taken place have occurred in remote and isolated stretches of the desert, and there's no one. The only, you know, accounts that are of the agent involved. Another piece is improving the complaints process so that CBP is responsive to complaints by communities, by migrants, et cetera, and also obviously ending the racial and religious profiling are just some of the
I think, best practices, policing best practices that need to be applied to CBP. More broadly, I mean, one piece just thinking of, there's a lot of, as you can all imagine, just really toxic legislation that comes out of Congress regarding that affects the border. From, you know, it's, I think the border is frequently a kind of a political pawn and, you know, a lot of pundits, discussion for pundits. But there is some sensible legislation out there, and I just wanted to highlight one piece of sensible legislation that's offered by Representative O'Rourke, who's a Democrat from Texas, and Pierce, who's a Republican from New Mexico. And why this is notable, the Border Enforcement Accountability Oversight and Community Engagement Act, is that it's bipartisan, piece of legislation, and has some measures for increasing transparency and accountability over CBP. So what are some other ways that people can respond? So I think trying to promote and push and saying, look, there are some positive pieces of legislation, and I don't, obviously, you know, some of these toxic pieces of legislation that call for dramatic increases, just, you know, piling more agents and resources and drones, et cetera, on our southern border is not the answer. So what can people do? I think getting involved, and there's a couple different ways that folks can get involved. I know that many folks on the phone are already very involved in a, you know, wide range of kind of social justice and immigration-oriented activities, and I think ways if you can, when you're doing these, kind of take into consideration the realities and concerns of the border region of CBP. So obviously folks who are in the border region, there's great humanitarian assistance work that's taking place and witnessing work, whether it's going and witnessing Streamline cases in kind of in Arizona in the Tucson sector, or going and providing water. There are a number of organizations in South Texas and San Diego and Southern Arizona that do provide direct humanitarian assistance. And I think another way of staying informed and advocating for reform, the organizations that Southern Border Communities Coalition releases information regarding what's going on the border. I know Kino Border Initiative, which is part of Jesuit Conference, they also have a program in Nogales and offer different updates and information reports about what's going on the border. And there are a number of other organizations that do that as well, American Friends Service Committee, et cetera. So I think just, you know, for folks who are interested in getting on listservs and looking for the action alerts. One of the things I think is incredibly important is for groups or individuals who are not in the border region to weigh in on this, because obviously I think, you know, organizations or groups in the border region who are directly impacted have one, I think, you know, members of Congress expect to hear from us, but I think hearing from the interior of the country, particularly as many members of Congress from the interior make a lot of statements and are calling for militarization of the region, but to hear, I think, pushback from their own constituents, I think is incredibly important. So to that end, meeting with elected officials and then speaking out, you know, op-eds, I think, you know, responding to, particularly in this time, you know, the border and immigration and all issues pertaining to the southern border are so highly politicized. I think speaking out in different parts of the country, not just here in D.C., but in your own community, is incredibly important. So thank you so much, and I will pass along to Shana.
Great. And this is Sharon. Just to thank you, Jennifer, as we get ready to hear from Shana, thank you for setting such a wonderful context for reviewing the power and the authority enacted by Customs and Border Patrol and reminding folks of the great economic power that has been given to that system. So Shana now will turn us to the impact upon humans, and particularly the ways that in the Northern Triangle of Central America, human lives have been impacted by the kind of border buildup and the militarization that Jennifer has spoken to. And as we get ready to hear from Shana, I just want to remind you, I'm sure having heard from Jennifer, you have questions that have arisen about border dynamics, or perhaps you want to know more about good or less than positive legislation, as she mentioned it. In order to prepare for asking questions, I invite you to move your cursor to the middle top of your screen, and when you take it, up, you'll see three bright green buttons. The middle button is the chat button. If you click on it, you can type in a question that you have down at the bottom of the chat button, and then we will get to those questions after we hear from Shana. So, Shana, we will indeed turn it over to you, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, no problem. Can everyone hear me?
We hear you well.
Okay, great. You never know when you push star six whether it went through or not. So I am kind of picking up where Jenny left off, in that my discussion is really going to focus on the fact that the U.S. is not only militarizing the border of the U.S. and Mexico, but also taking our border policy further afield, and has been very supportive of a buildup in militarization on Mexico's border with Guatemala, particularly in the last several years, as we've seen more and more people seeking safe haven from the humanitarian situation currently gripping the Northern Triangle of Central America. This first slide gives you some perspective on what we're talking about when we talk about the humanitarian situation in the Northern Triangle of Central America. The Northern Triangle of Central America is encompassed by the three countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And just in the last year, those three countries, which are actually the size of Oregon, all put together, or the size of Oregon and home to 30 million people, experienced 17,500 violent deaths. And that surpasses the death toll in every war zone in the world except for Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. So when we're talking about this tiny little region of the world home to 30 million people, we really are talking about region where many of the aspects that you find in zones of open conflict are currently characterizing the situation in the region. If you look at that infographic, you can see the comparison between the deaths that we're seeing in the Northern Triangle and the deaths that the violent deaths of impacting the region in Western Africa that's impacted by the Boko Haram insurgency. And it gives you some perspective about why people are leaving in such record numbers from the region. Just to also highlight a few things, 11%, the death toll was 11% higher in 2015 than it was the previous year in 2014. And yet I think that many of us are aware that there were fewer arrivals in the United States of unaccompanied children seeking safe haven and slightly fewer family arrivals than in 2014. The reason for that is very clear to those of us who've been working with groups that are responding to the humanitarian situation on the southern border of Mexico, and that's that the U.S. has exported our border policy to Mexico's southern border, and this buildup of militarization in the southern border region of Mexico, of course, is going to have all of the consequences that Jenny just walked us through in terms of what has typified the situation in the southern border of the U.S. But even more perilous is that this border militarization and border buildup is happening in a situation in which the public forces and officials are struggling with impunity, are troubled by human rights records, far more egregious in recent years than the human rights record of our own government in our own country. And this is going to, of course, entail the return of people to precarious situations where their lives and liberty might be in danger. It means that people are crossing in more perilous routes and are undergoing more precarious journeys, and that the officials that are carrying out these immigration control tactics are far less accountable and are regularly violating people's human rights. It also means the empowerment of traffickers who seek to profit off of the vulnerability of people who are forced even more underground in response to roving checkpoints, border militarization, and increased detention and deportation. Next slide, please. Here you see a quote by Francisco Palmieri, who is the Assistant Secretary for Central America and the Caribbean. As he says here in March 2015, in front of a Senate hearing, Mexico has really been a key element in helping the U.S. lower levels of unaccompanied children reaching our border since last summer. And while we've actually seen a recent uptick in the number of children arriving on our border, really since August of 2015, there's been a marked increase. That should be an indication of the fact that enforcing our way out of this out of the problems facing people in the Northern Triangle is simply not a viable option. The reason that people are arriving in greater numbers is because now smuggling networks have figured out how to get around Mexico's new controls. But just take a look at this slide, which is offered in Washington Office on Latin America report, which I'll cite to later on in the presentation as a resource that you should really look at as you attempt to learn more on this issue. What WOLA found was that there was a 71% increase in Mexico's apprehensions and, indeed, in many cases, deportations of Central American migrants, including asylum seekers and refugees and children. And so one of the things that WOLA actually said in a previous report is that the Obama administration has gotten Mexico to take on the role of deporter in chief. Next slide, please. So this is actually a statement from way back in 2012, in which the then CBP chief, you heard of CBP just a few minutes ago from Jenny, was outlining really what his vision was for U.S. border control. And he said very clearly that the Guatemalan border with Chiapas, Mexico, is now our southern border. And you can hear Border Patrol agents and officers talk about the way in which they attack, quote-unquote, threats now, not at our border with Mexico, but rather Mexico's border with Guatemala. And what does that mean in points of fact? Mexico's National Migration Institute, starting in July of 2014, really began to deploy what they call their southern border strategy. They reassigned over 300 additional agents to the southern border of Mexico, established additional roving checkpoints, increased enforcement operations along the highways, along the train route, and in hostels and other lodgings where migrants are known to stay. They took steps to prohibit migrants from riding the trains, the famous bestia, which I think many of you probably have seen depicted in pictures and in movies. And they have also posted agents, including paid private security guards, or mercenaries as some human rights groups are calling them, on the train route. And these private security guards have actually shot migrants pretty frequently and have participated in what people are calling migrant hunts. Much of the support that the U.S. is sending down to Mexico comes in the name of building up a 21st century border on Mexico's border with Guatemala. They say that they're facilitating legitimate commerce and the movement of people while curtailing the illicit flow of drugs, people, arms, and cash. Migrant rights advocates have reported that INM agents are now carrying cattle prods, and that they've used those to shock people off of trains, and that the Mexican government's hired private security contractors engage in far more egregious human rights violations, including depriving people of their lives. We've supported the equipping, training, and other kind of technical assistance to the tune of $100 million in Merida initiative money. And there is a lot of interest from Congress in doing more. Chairwoman Granger, who's the chairwoman of the State and Foreign Operations Committee, subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee in Congress, has actually said that we must do all that we can to help Mexico strengthen its borders, that it's key in preventing migrants from arriving in the United States. And all of this is happening within a context in which the U.S. has actually acknowledged that we're facing both a migrant crisis and a refugee crisis in our hemisphere. President Obama, many of you might have noticed in his State of the Union address, acknowledged that Central America has the kinds of instability that is spurring a refugee movement. He acknowledged Central America's Northern Triangle along with Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. So while the administration has, to a certain extent, internalized the fact that there is a refugee crisis, that people are dying at rates typically seen in conflict zones, that people are being persecuted and displaced within Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. At the same time, we're equipping and financing the kind of crackdown in Mexico that we've decried in other parts of the world. We've been very vociferous in our country has been very vociferous in advocating for continued access for refugees fleeing Syria to Lebanon and Turkey, and yet at the same time we're saying that Mexico should be our key partner in blocking the ability of people from Central America to find safe haven. As Mexico has blocked refugees from moving forward in their journey to find safe haven, it has placed obstacles in the way of them also applying for asylum in Mexico. Those who are detained by migration officials in Mexico are often told that their process, if they choose to seek asylum, would take months or a year, and that they'd be better off allowing deportations to go forward. Some are held in jails where rats roam, where the food is absolutely disgusting, and while the Mexican government has said that children are not to be detained in detention centers, in fact, we have evidence that children are continuing to be detained in Mexico's detention centers. The approval rate for asylum seekers in Mexico is less than half of the asylum approval rate in the United States, and Mexico granted asylum to just 18 children last year. Next slide, please. So as I said, these are some key resources to learn more about the current situation facing migrants seeking to travel into Mexico and perhaps seeking journeys towards the United States. These migrants, including refugees and asylum seekers, face really grave obstacles in actually attaining protection in Mexico. And it's something that we have direct involvement in, and we really would like more people in the U.S. to be knowledgeable about it and to speak out against the ways in which our government is engaging and supporting the infrastructure of immigration enforcement without putting the requisite amount of energy and investment into the infrastructure of refugee protection. I recommend to you a great a great article that was written by Al Jazeera. You see the link there. And the report released by Washington Office in Latin America in November 2015, which very clearly outlines what we're talking about. I also ask that maybe you consider engaging in a similar effort to that being spearheaded by the Ignatian Solidarity Network for this February. This February, the Ignatian Solidarity Network, echoing many of the themes that we expect to be front and center as the Pope visits Mexico, will be asking our network of Jesuit-affiliated people to take action and write to their members of Congress and to sign on to a letter aimed at educating members of Congress on these issues. You can go to the link that I've pasted in there and see what the four asks are on the ISN's letter. There are also a bunch of other really great resources that ISN has put up there in order to help faith groups, Catholic groups, but also those further afield to lift up the message of Pope Francis in his work trying to really rally for migrants' rights in Mexico. And I hope that you all would join us in this effort. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Shana, very much. And again, we want to encourage anyone who'd like to add to questions in the chat box to go up to the top of your screen, scroll there. You'll see three bright green dots. The middle of them is the chat function, and you can ask your question there or begin to form it. And in just a few minutes as we move into our discussion time, we'll have an opportunity for folks to ask questions, which you'll be able to do them by pressing *6, which will unmute you in order to be able to do that. At this point, though, we're going to move through a few other slides quickly that offer some additional resources related to the recent ICE raids and picking up on and providing some updates to resources that are available now as a follow-up to last month's webinar. There was just today some information shared through Immigration Impact. You'll see the link there. That was a letter written by mothers who themselves had been victimized through the immigration raids who have been detained in Texas. Their letter is to President Obama. It's very powerful, certainly to hear in their own words what this experience of the human rights violations that they have experienced has been like. As well, we want to make sure we lift up that we have a new letter among heads of communion and national leaders of a number of faith organizations. As of just before this call, we had more than two dozen national organizations and or heads of communions who had signed on just within the last few days. This letter will be delivered tomorrow to the White House as a part of a multi-partner press conference that we'll be holding, again, asking for the release of those who have been victimized by the raids and for the stoppage of the raids. And a groundswell letter is a third letter. We'll send you the link to that as well. Many of you hopefully have signed on. Again, all together, as we said at the front end of the call, more than 133,000 faith community leaders have signed to ask for the raids to be halted. We'll go to the next slide and highlight here, if you haven't yet had a chance to see it, a very powerful report put out several days ago by United We Dream, reporting on the impact of the raids. Also, you can find as a part of that report a link to the very disturbing footage of a mother actually being separated by ICE officials during a raid, seemingly as she was taking a child to deliver at school. And we hope that you might consider sharing some of those realities with your faith community so that they can understand better the deep impact and struggles that are caused by families when these kind of policies continue to be perpetuated. National Immigration Law Center just today has highlighted again a new fact sheet about the ICE raids, as well as a number of materials you can find on their website to help immigrant friends you may know to be sure of how to protect themselves if they're approached by ICE. And we invite some who may be interested as well that just on Wednesday of this week, there is another webinar that will be sponsored by the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society on the deportation of Central American refugees, and that will be happening at 2 p.m., and you can see a link there for how to register. We'll go forward to the next slide. And we want to ask you as well to stay tuned for additional resources that will be being made available through Interfaith Immigration Coalition partners on our interfaithimmigration.org website. As you click on religious holiday resources, we'll be producing President's Day resources that will be targeted towards helping to further educate your faith communities related to the ICE raids. And then Lenten and Passover resources soon to come. As we know, Ash Wednesday is coming already next week on Wednesday, the 10th of February. So do continue to look for those. And we'll go to the next slide, which moves us into our time for the final 10 minutes of our call of questions and discussions. And in going to our chat box, we did have a comment at the beginning just asking if either of you would like to add additional thoughts about the roles that you hope the Pope may play in highlighting border practices. I think, Shana, you referred to those a little bit, but is there anything else that you would like to add, or Jennifer, you either? And again, if you're not already unmuted by star 6, you can do that to be heard again.
Hey, this is Shana. I'm hoping, you know, the Pope is visiting both borders of Mexico, that he's visiting the southern border of Mexico, where he's going to be meeting in indigenous territory, and he's also visiting our border with Mexico in Juarez. And I'm really hoping that he will be strong and prophetic in the way that he was prophetic in front of our lawmakers to really challenge Mexico about what's really been the erosion of respect for refugee rights in Mexico. Mexico has a long tradition of being a destination country for refugees. Mexico took in refugees much as the U.S. did during World War II. They also received many refugees from the Dirty War in Argentina and those who fled Pinochet in Chile. And it's really really sad and disheartening to see the role that the Peña Nieto administration is playing in partnership with the U.S. in blocking access for refugees coming from Central America. So I hope that the Pope is able to frame it in those terms. He was so skilled in framing the migration issues in the U.S. from the point of view of kind of our national heritage and lifting up kind of our faith leaders who called us to be more righteous in our dealings with people who are marginalized or made to feel like strangers within our society. And I'm hoping for a similar message and call from the Pope. And this might be a little bit apolitic of me to say, but I'm really hoping that he'll call on the Mexican bishops to similarly invest time and treasure and advocacy into migrants' rights work as the U.S. bishops have really done over the last, for quite some time, but definitely over the last 20 years. The Mexican bishop's voice is really important in this debate and could spark some new energy around addressing migrants' rights issues. And I'm hoping that the Pope will be able to energize those within the Mexican Bishops Conference who want to take on the issue of migration.
That's great. Thanks, Shana. And we can refer folks again to the resources Shana had talked about, the Ignatian Solidarity Network, as well as the Jesuit Conference, Pope-related resources and some lovely worship and Bible study resources that just have been introduced over the last week as well that connect with the Pope's visit. Thank you. And Jenny, maybe we'll go to you then for the next question. There was one that was related to the legislation that you had discussed and wondering from both of you, but Jenny, we'll start with you, whether there are priority states, targeted states that are focused on in trying to uplift and raise up other partners to be able to support the O'Rourke and Pierce legislation and perhaps other positive efforts.
Hi, yeah, this is Jenny. So in terms of, I think it's kind of two different pieces. I think that members throughout the country, regardless of what committees, et cetera, what they serve at, I think it's very useful for them to hear from the constituents that they are concerned about these issues, just put on the radar, and so that hopefully that these members don't default back to, border security equals more militarization, more is better for the border region when it comes to enforcement personnel, et cetera. I think it's leadership in both the House and the Senate side in the relevant committees, whether it's Homeland Security, also Judiciary Committee touches on some of these issues, and then appropriations, I think, on both sides in both chambers.
I also think that several important members of Congress to concentrate on, I think, are Candace Miller and Representative McCall. Miller is from she's from Michigan, and mm-hmm. McCall is from Texas, and they're powerful on the Homeland Security Committee in the House, and would be key allies if this bill was to move forward, and we really do need more Republican sponsorship on this bill. Pierce, it's very good that it's a bipartisan bill, and that Steve Pierce has agreed that more accountability is needed on border law enforcement, but things are so polarized right now that that before another Democrat signs on as a co-sponsor to the bill, we do need to see more interest among the Republicans as well.
Great, thank you. And we have a question as well about if you can help us understand the relation between Guatemala and Mexican migration detention at the border. Is there a cooperation between them as nations?
So actually, interestingly, there's been cooperation both with Mexico, or both with Guatemala and with Honduras, and certainly it's been more robust with Honduras in that the U.S. And actually Border Patrol speaks very openly about this. They say that they went when the quote miners crisis began. That they went with Mexico after several years of working with Mexico to Guatemala and Honduras and asked Guatemala and Honduras to cooperate in intercepting children as they leave or attempt to leave Guatemala and Honduras. And that has actually been done more consistently on the border of Honduras than the border of Honduras and Guatemala than on the border of Guatemala and Mexico. I think in part because the vast presence of immigration control enforcers in Mexico kind of obviates the need to invest a lot in the infrastructure of interceptions on the Guatemala side. But the U.S. government has partnered with the military in Guatemala to execute these interceptions, and with the national police, specifically the Tigres in Honduras, to implement interceptions of children without, in either case, any screening to ensure that those children are not fleeing traffickers or persecutors.
And then the second half of that question that had been brought to us by Pat Rumor, who is on the call, was recognizing that Guatemala has asked the U.S. government to investigate sexual abuse of unaccompanied minors, wondering what we can do about that reality.
So I think that a lot of us saw the reports in the press this past week. I think it was first an AP reporter, and then it was picked up in the New York Times about the fact that some of the youth who were released from ORR custody actually ended up in sex or labor trafficking situations. We, of course, are very concerned about this. I would caution against some of the rhetoric that we're hearing out of both Republicans and Democrats, particularly in the Senate, saying that children should be kept in detention to keep them safe from would-be traffickers upon release from ORR custody. The reason that ORR was given custody of children who are unaccompanied children was because they are far better situated as an agency to deal with child protection issues. Unfortunately, ORR has been under-resourced in recent years, particularly in light of the breadth of issues arising around the uptick in the arrival of unaccompanied minors in the United States. Only 4% of children who are released from ORR custody actually receive home visits. Both Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service and the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, which are two of the leading child protection advocacy and assistance groups that work with the Office for Refugee Resettlement within HHS, have advocated for 100% of children released from ORR to have home visits. And unfortunately, there just hasn't been the funding and resources for that to happen. We've also advocated for background checks of people who are being who kids are being released to, without obviating or without obstructing the ability of parents who are undocumented to reunite with their children through that process. So it's a very complicated issue, and I'm afraid that the press is perhaps not doing justice to the complexity of the issue. I would also point out that children have credible allegations that children have suffered abuse, neglect in ICE detention, we know detention to be a far more dangerous environment in terms of really having an impact on children's cognitive development.
Thank you, Shana. I'd like to, we're a few minutes past the hour, but I want to give one final shout out to our listeners and invite you to press *6 if there is a remaining burning question that you would like to ask before we close. All right, and if not hearing that, again, we want to thank you for joining us, especially we want to thank you, Jenny, and you, Shana, for all of the insights, the important reminders, and especially the calls to action that you have given to us.
Hello?
Hi. Did you have a final question you wanted to ask?
Yes, if you can hear me. Yes, Can our American bishops do a campaign in our parishes to wake us up to this crisis?
Shana, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, so there's been, I think, a lot of information shared by the Bishops Justice for Immigrants campaign and from other Catholic partners in that campaign on the issues facing people, the people of the Northern Triangle of Central America and our border communities and the ways in which people are being prevented from seeking safe haven in Mexico. I think it's a great idea for us to be engaging in a more intentional way at the parish level to make sure that parishes are more aware of these issues and that social justice committees at parishes and other well-meaning people can take action and hold our government representatives accountable for the choices that they're making on these issues. I think there's a wealth of information available at the Justice for Immigrants website and also at the Interfaith Immigration Coalition website to get parishes more involved and for people to organize their parishes. I think we really depend on you all down at the grassroots to bring these issues to the attention of your pastors, of your leaders of congregation, and to let them know that you're aware and interested in leading efforts at the parish level. And I think that when they hear that, then we can be strategic in reaching out with resources and ways in which people can become, can educate their communities.
And thank you for that important question. And we will also endeavor to share specifically the links of resources that have just come out, again, that are wonderful Bible study, prayer, worship, connected resources that can be used very easily within parish and other congregational settings. We'll share those as we send out the full PowerPoint, both the visual portion and the audio portion. And we thank you. We thank you immensely and in ongoing ways on these border issues and on so many others related to the civil rights and the human protections of refugees and immigrants. Your partnership is vital. We need to continue to grow it in every faith community that we can. And thank you immensely for the wisdom of our speakers, but for your participation, for your ongoing work everywhere you're located around the country. We'll look forward, we hope, to you being with us for our next month's webinar. Stay tuned for word about that from the Interfaith Immigration Coalition. And thanks again so much for joining us today. Have a good month. Bye-bye.
Thank you.